site too. And those are always really great times to be able to eat together, to be able to fellowship and have some good time together. And Sunday's a little bit different. You know, Sunday is a day in where we can gather and be strengthened as a church in a very different way through our worship, through our interaction. So as we're here together, you know, we're here to look at God's word. And the passage we have in front of us is James chapter 5. We're basically wrapping up our series that we started months ago in James. And we've hit this really interesting topic at the end, which is patience. I was kind of struggling because patience is not one of my strong suits. You know, I'm one of these people that if I'm in a car in a traffic jam, if no one's moving, then I'm the one like, you know, I'm the one who's kind of flustered, probably not as bad as I used to be. Or if we're at a restaurant and it's taking a long time for the food to come out, then I'm the one like, my gosh, where's the food? Why is it taking, you know, I kind of have that sense. But I think a lot of us do. You know, and patience is one of those funny attributes or funny characteristics that if you pray for God to make you more patient, he puts you in impatient situations. All of a sudden you pray and say, Lord, make me more patient, you find yourself in the longest line to the grocery store. You know, you find yourself in the lane on the highway that's, you know, just inching along. You find yourself in situations where things don't move along the way you want to. Patience is also interesting because it's really a secondary characteristic. It's not in and of itself. It's not an incredibly important thing. It always matches up with something else that makes the other thing important. So for instance, if you're in a situation where where someone is being frustrating to you and you can lash out, patience is something that makes you more loving, right? Patience isn't a characteristic that by itself is incredibly important, but it's something that you use in the context of other characteristics. And so here, what James does is he's not simply saying, be patient. He's talking about it in the midst of suffering. And so if you take a moment really quickly, go back to chapter 1, just a page or two back for you. If you go back in James chapter 2, James chapter 1, when we started, the very first message, we said that the book of James starts with this. He says, count it all joy, my brothers, when you face trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. So if you notice, James is kind of bookending his entire letter with the topic of suffering. And when he comes back to patience here, he's not just saying, be patient because I say it's you should be patient. Be patient because God wants you to be patient. He says, in your suffering, you need to be patient. And so we're going to be examining that. And what I wanted to remind you of is the fact that Christianity has an absolutely unique understanding, unique view of suffering compared to any other religion. You know, there are a lot of religions that when it comes to suffering, they say suffering should be avoided at all costs. And so people in those religions go to great lengths to make sure that suffering comes, they escape it. And they do everything they can to avoid it, no matter what that means. Christianity is also different because it doesn't say that Christianity should be embraced. And there are even some Christians who say suffering is something to be embraced. I've shared with you guys this, but one of the missionaries that I worked with for a little while, he kind of sat in this camp where he said that, you know, the more we suffer, the more we're like Christ. And he would put suffering in his own life. Now, he's the kind of guy that would put rocks in his shoes and then walk 5 miles just so that he could be like Christ in that way. And I think Christianity really isn't like that. Christianity is very unique because it says that suffering isn't to be avoided, but it's not to be embraced. But in God's hands, it can be transformative in your life. And in a lot of ways, that's what James is talking about. He's talking about the fact that suffering has this very unique place, that at the heart of Christianity is suffering, that Jesus died on the cross for us, and that suffering has a very unique place that it can transform us. That's one of the reasons why in James 1, 2, and 4 that I just read, he doesn't just say we should have joy in the midst of suffering. He says, in your suffering, suffering can produce steadfastness, and if you let it have what? Its full effect, it will make you more like Christ. Well, what do you need in the midst of your suffering that will cause it to have full effect? Patience. You need patience in the midst of your suffering that will allow the suffering to take full hold of you, to have full effect, and to develop you, to transform you, to have the character of Christ. And so basically that's what we're going to be dealing with today, is how do we develop patience in the midst of our sufferings and our trials and our difficulties? And basically what I think what James says is I think he's saying that we need to ask ourselves, in the midst of suffering and trials, we need to ask ourselves three questions that will help us exercise patience. And these are the three questions. First question is, what can I do? Second question is, who am I up against? And the third question is, what is God doing? As you ask these questions in the midst of suffering and trials, it lets you begin to understand and exercise patience, and thus grow in steadfastness and hopefully become more like Christ. So we're going to go through each question one by one. And the first question in the midst of suffering is this: what can I do? Okay, in the midst of your sufferings, trials, what can I do? If you go to verses 7 and 8, James says this. He says, "Be patient, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand." Beautiful passage. I love the fact that he says, establish your hearts. He's telling us that we need to prepare for times of difficulty, that we need to prepare ourselves to persevere, to be patient, to be steadfast. And when it comes to suffering, when it comes to difficulty, when it comes to trials, there's basically, if you were to ask yourself the question, what can I do? There's two pious answers, right? In the midst of difficulty, if you were to say, what can I do? One of the things that immediately rings back is Philippians. I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. And that's a great passage to pull up. It's not quite, I think, the context that we're talking about here with suffering. Another pious answer that people can give in the midst of suffering is if they ask themselves, what can I do? For some people, they ask, well, nothing. I mean, God's going to take care of it. And again, that's a pious answer. There's some truth to it that we need to trust God, but it's not the answer that James is getting to here. There's a very specific answer, a very specific thing that James wants us to be thinking about in the midst of our trials and sufferings, and it's this. In verse 7, he commands us to be patient. He tells us that we need to be exercising patience. And you know, one of the really difficult things in the midst of suffering is when suffering hits us, when trial hits us, our initial reaction for a lot of us is to get out from under it, right? I mean, that's the initial kind of reaction is, you know, how can I get away from this? How can I get out from it? How can I fix it? How can I change it? I need to do something. And if you notice what James is saying, he's not saying that. He's saying what you need to do is you need to be patient. And the Christian life isn't about throwing off whatever problem comes your way every time it comes your way. It's not about when suffering hits you saying, how can I get out from under this? You know, he's saying, be patient. Be steadfast. And steadfastness is a beautiful word. Now, steadfastness is the idea that bad things happen, but they don't change me, right? Suffering, difficulties, trials happen, but I remain steady. And you know, what that requires is it requires patience. It means that whenever bad things happen, I'm not trying to get out from it. I'm not trying to fix it right away. I'm not trying to do something. But at the same time, what James is saying is he's not saying that patience is being inactive. That's the other extreme. On one extreme, we want to fix it. We want to change it. We want to make it better. On the other extreme, we say, well, then I guess I shouldn't do anything. I want you to listen to the illustration that James gives, and it's incredibly instructive. You know, he uses this illustration of a farmer, and a farmer is a perfect picture of a patience, right? When you think about a farmer, what do you think about? Guy who's outstanding in his field, right? Guy who's just kind of doing whatever, doesn't seem to be moving very fast, doing very much. A hard worker, but there's times where he just has to wait. But if you listen to the illustration, there's actually something else going on, and I want to key you into that. James says, see how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and late rain. You also be patient. Now, when you think about the illustration of the farmer, again, you know, for the people that he's talking to, they understand agriculture. You know, for you and I, I think for most of us, very few of us grew up on a farm. Very few of us grew up in agriculture. Maybe some of you did some gardening and there's some connections there. But he's speaking to a group of people who understand agriculture. You know, they understand whether it's their main career, whether it's something they did in the past, whether it's something that they do on the side. I mean, they understand agriculture. And he uses this illustration. And the illustration isn't simply about a guy who goes out and once he's planted the seed, kind of waits for things to happen, you know, twiddles his thumbs and, boy, when are they going to come in? When's the rain going to come? When do I get to pick the flower, or the fruit off of the trees or the vines or whatever it is that he's growing? I mean, for a people who understand agriculture, they understand that the farmer has a job that's much, much deeper, much more entailed than simply planting seeds and waiting. You know, for people who understand agriculture, they understand all the different things the farmer does, that before the seed ever hits the ground, there's work to be done. You know, the farmer prepares the ground, he prepares the soil, he tills it, he sections it off, he decides what's going to go where, he plans it out, he understands how the rotation of crops works. And then finally, at some point, he digs the hole and he puts the seed in. And for people who understand agriculture, they understand the moment the seed goes in the ground, again, there's work to be done. It isn't that, again, he puts the seed in the ground, covers it, goes in his house and says, okay, this is going to be 6 months, twiddles his thumbs, waiting for things to come up. I mean, for a good farmer in an agrarian society, they understand that the farmer has still a lot of things to do, that he goes out, that he checks on it, that he fertilizes it, that he checks on the soil, that as the plants are coming up, he protects them, and that he does things that will help them be fruitful. For instance, if you're growing tomatoes, you know, if you've grown things in your garden, you know, if you get a tomato plant or any other kind of plant, if it starts tipping over, you go out there and you begin to wrap it with a little stick so that it stands up straight and the fruit grows where it can reach sun. If you're growing strawberries, you cover it with straw so that it has the warmth and the temperature to be able to be really fruitful, to have as many as possible and grow them as big as possible. And so for an agrarian culture, these people understand that the farmer, the patience, isn't simply putting seed in the ground and letting it go and saying, okay, when is the rain going to come? The rain better come because my stuff needs to grow. In an agrarian culture, James brings up a farmer, and what a farmer has to do is he has to realize that there are things that are in his control and things that are out of his control. And that's a very important distinction to make. You know, they don't have irrigation at the time. They don't have central water where they can pipe in and flood the land so that they make sure they have enough. They have to wait for the rain. And so at this period, I mean, for farmers, they had to understand what they could do, what they couldn't do. And what they had to do was they had to do the things they could do, that they should do. And so, you know, what we see here is we see a picture where patience isn't being inactive. Matter of fact, I will tell you this. If you're in a period of trial or difficulty and suffering and you are inactive, it's a better chance that the inactivity comes from laziness or a false sense of faith, hey, God will take care of this, than anything else. Patience isn't about being inactive. When you're in periods of difficulty and trials and sufferings, patience means realizing what is in your control, what is in your responsibility, and doing those things, but also understanding what is in God's and letting God do his. And that might seem like an easy thing, but when bad things happen, not only do we take on the things that we think we can take on, we try to do the things that only God can do too. And so in the midst of difficulty and trials, it's important to be able to pull back and to say, what can I do? What should I do? And as you begin to delineate that, you begin to see where you need to be active, where you need to be working, where you need to be trying, where you need to be fixing things in your life, where you need to be attentive. And then you also need to be realizing that there are certain things that you need to be praying about because only God can do. And it's only until you understand that delineation that you're able to truly persevere, be patient through difficulties and sufferings. If your experience through trials and sufferings is to be inactive, then there's a great temptation to be angry at God because God moves pretty slow sometimes. Or if your temptation is to fix things and fix things and fix things, then you will never grow in Christ because you'll never trust him. You'll do your darndest to get yourself out of it, and it may or may not be the way God wants you to, but you will never see God work in the midst of your problem. And so you will never love him more, you will never trust him more. And so the idea of a farmer is this idea of knowing what God has put into your hands to do and realizing what is only in his hands to do. That's a very important question. Matter of fact, I would say for some of you in the midst of your trial, your suffering right now, you don't know what to do. You're not sure what you should be doing. And that's a very important question. Lord, what is in my hands that I should be thinking about, that I should be considering, that I should be working on? And Lord, what is in yours that I should pray about, that I should leave in your hands, that I should tell other people about, to be praying for me about, that I should trust you for? And then as you begin to move forward, you're able to move forward in a way that is filled with faith because you are trusting, but you are doing. You know, you are taking care of what God has put onto your plate, but you're also trusting him for the full result of. Now, that's a very unique dynamic to be happening in your life, but that's an important first question in the midst of trials and suffering to say, what can I do? What should I be doing? See, so that's the first thing that James addresses. Second question is this. He says there's another question we need to be asking, and the second question is, who am I up against? Now, this comes up in a very interesting way. Verse 8, kind of going back to what we read just a second ago, James says, you also be patient. He says, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Then he goes on, verse 9, he says, do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. Now, it's interesting that he uses that idea. He says, do not grumble against your brothers. And the reason why he brings that up is commentators say consistently what James is doing is he's addressing his audience. He's addressing the problems he's seeing in the church. And so apparently when he says, do not grumble against your brothers, what he's seeing is that in the midst of Christians dealing with suffering, brothers are turning against brothers. People are turning against people they shouldn't be turning against. Christians are turning against other Christians, and it's causing strife in the church. And so what he's calling Christians to do is to watch their relationships carefully. And you know, when you go through church history, I know church history is a real bore and a snooze for some people, but it's really interesting. One of the things that they struggled with was early on in church history, as persecution was kind of clamping down on the church, you had situations where people to varying degrees were experiencing persecution or not experiencing persecution. And not only was it affecting, you know, people's testimony of faith, of being faithful, it was also causing these schisms in the church. Matter of fact, there was actually a big discussion that went on within the church as a whole, which was this. If a Christian is brought before the Roman authorities and he's told to recant and to deny Christ, and he does say, you know, I deny Christ, what happens when he starts coming to church? Do we embrace him? Do we force him to repent? Do we make him re-accept Christ? Does that show us that he doesn't believe in Jesus Christ? And so there's a lot of aspersions being cast. There are divisions. There are things that people are saying against one another. And what James was seeing was the fact that suffering wasn't strengthening the church. There were times where suffering was tearing the church apart by the ways that Christians treated each other. And you know, we might not be in a situation like that, but what does happen to us is in the midst of our trials and sufferings, it puts a strain on relationships, doesn't it? You know, for some people, the strain is this. You know, the suffering and the difficulties and the trials hit in your life, and it builds up, whether it's difficulties at work, whether it's personal difficulties. And for some people, what happens? Well, after a little while, you begin to take it out on other people, right? You go home after a crummy day of crummy work, and, you know, wife greets you at the door, and the first thing you do is you lash out. Impatience, right? Or your kids want to play, and they come running up to you, and you've had a really difficult day, and the first thing that happens, you snap at them. Or even if you're not married, right? You're going through a trial and suffering. A friend calls and says, hey, do you want to meet? No. Right? You're short with them, and you begin to kind of collapse in on yourself. You know, that's one of the ways in which suffering and trials can be destructive in relationships. You know, we lash out at people, we're short with them, we're short-tempered with them, we use them to let out our frustrations. You know, we get yelled at work, we come home and we yell at someone else, and we feel like, you know, we feel better because we've somehow vented the frustration, the angers. There's another way that our relationships get screwed up in the midst of trials and sufferings in which they get strained, and it's this. We're in the midst of trials and sufferings, and they're weighing on our hearts, and they're weighing on our lives. And eventually, we become disappointed that the people who are Christians, who we call friends, don't seem to do as much as we expected them to. And it stings us, and it hurts us. we don't get the kind of support that we were expecting, or certain people that we try to go to, we try to open up to, just really don't seem to engage us for whatever reason. And when we feel that, when we experience that, then we push them out. We push back on them. You see, there's different ways that in the midst of trials and sufferings, relationships can be strained. And you know, one of the terrible things in sufferings is we feel alone. We feel cut off from people. And if we're not careful, we end up not only just feeling cut off, we end up actually cutting off from people. And in the church, you know, the danger to that is because in the midst of trials and sufferings, the people that we need the most are the people that we are the most prone to push away. It's family, it's Christian friends. Those are the times when we need them most. And yet those are the times where those relationships are the easiest to strain. And some of you experience that. Some of you experienced relationships where on one side or the other, you know, you're going through suffering and you lash out at people and you don't know why. And after a couple of lashes, maybe the first time you apologize, say, oh, I'm really sorry, that wasn't me. I don't know where that came from. After the third or fourth time you do it, you just kind of let it go. But eventually those people don't want to be close to you. Or maybe you've experienced the other one where you've gone through suffering, and as you've tried to turn to people and not receive that prayer and that help that you've thought, you said, well, forget this. I guess it's not what I thought. I guess faith really isn't what I thought it was supposed to be. I guess being brothers and sisters in Christ, being believers, being a church doesn't work. And you see, what James is trying to say is, he's trying to say, prepare yourself. And one of the ways you can prepare yourself is by asking yourself, who am I up against? You know, we need our brothers and sisters in Christ, and we need them more than we, especially in difficulties and sufferings. Now, they are the ones who truly and deeply can understand us, and they are the ones who have the ability to truly and deeply help us. But you see, in those times, what we end up doing is we end up fighting with them. And when James says, do not grumble against one another, he's not just giving us a command that's saying, don't do it. I think it's based on this idea where one of the questions we have to ask is, who am I up against? And when you ask that question in the midst of difficulty or trial or suffering, you begin to realize that your true fight, your true battle is not with the people you're trying to push away. It's not with your spouse. I mean, they have very little to do with the stuff that's going on, and to lash out at that person or to lash out at your kids is ridiculous. They're not the reason why these things are happening to you. Or to be short with your Christian friends, or to push them away because they aren't doing the things that you expected them to do or you were hoping that for them to do. They're not the ones that are really the heart of the problem. When you ask yourself, who am I really up against? You begin to realize that they're not the ones you're fighting, and they're not the ones you should be fighting. Paul tells us a couple times, he tells us in Romans, he tells us in Ephesians, that our real fight is against three things. It's against the world, the flesh, and the devil. And you know, that's an important distinction to make. It's important to realize that when there are external things happening, when we're in the midst of sufferings and trials and difficulties, that the root of it is in one of those three things. And the reason why it's so important is because it changes the focus of your attention and your action. You begin to realize that you shouldn't be fighting these people and that you should be fighting these. And it completely changes your perspective. I remember I heard a message on this long, long time ago as a Christian. And I remember, you know, really kind of resonating with that idea that, you know, our fight is against the world and the flesh and the devil. And at the time, I really didn't know what it meant. But I remember the next time I went through a difficulty, I remember, like, thinking about that particular passage in Romans and in Ephesians 6:12. And I remember, like, processing that. And I remember how much of a shift it felt to, you know, to go from, you know, being angry or feeling like lashing out at people, saying, you know what, the real enemy that I have in this problem right now is my own flesh, it's my own sin. And then turning my rage against my own sinfulness, my own stubbornness, or against the world and saying, you know, the sinful world is the reason why I'm suffering. Or the devil's working here and moving into prayer and being diligent and being determined about that. But you see, if you don't ask that question, you end up fighting everyone around you and not really the people that you should be fighting against. We need to be asking the question from time to time, and in the midst of our suffering and difficulty, who am I up against? Because if we don't ask that, then we begin to feel and act as if it's everyone else that we're up against. And it's not. It really isn't. You know, we fight the world, we fight the flesh, we fight the devil. And God has given us people around us, different relationships, in order to help us, to encourage us, to strengthen us, to speak into our problems, to stand by us. And those people aren't the people that we should be fighting against. As you turn your attention, as you turn your enemy, as you turn your energies towards fighting those things, then you begin to realize that even if people on the outside are problematic, you need them, and that it doesn't make sense to push them away. That at different points in your suffering, you need to bring them in, and they are going to help you. So that's an incredibly important question to ask in the midst of trial and suffering, is who am I up against? And then that focuses your attention to the right things in the right ways, and that allows you to not push people away, because they're the people that you're going to need in the long run that are going to help you through the problems that you're going through. The third question is this. The third question is, what is God doing? If you go into verse 10 and 11, James says, "And as an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful." I don't know how many of you have read the book of Job, but James brings up two examples, the farmer and the prophets, and in particular, he brings up Job. If you've never read it, you should go read it. It's a really, really long book. Gets boring in some sections, but it's really interesting story. If you haven't read it, it's a story about, it begins with a story of a man who had great wealth. And it's a real real story. It's not an extended parable. It's not a metaphor. It's about a man who has great wealth. He's a man who was admired by all in his time, and he had a wonderful family. And in the span of a day or two, he loses his wealth, he loses his family, and he loses his health. It's so bad, he goes from having everything to nothing so quickly that even the people who are left in his life, his wife comes and says, "You should curse God and die," and then walks away. His four friends come, and his four friends' message to him is this: "You know, Job, all these terrible things happen to you, they're your fault. You sinned, you disobeyed God, they're your fault." I mean, imagine that in your life. You lose your family, you lose your wealth, you lose everything, you lose your health, and the only people left in your life say, "Curse God, it's your fault," right? I mean, that's a terrible turn of events. The amazing thing about the book of Job is the story is told over 42 chapters, so it is a little bit difficult to read, but Job goes back and forth with his four friends, and though he's tempted to lash out at God, he never really blames God. He never shakes the fist at God and says, "How dare you? You know, I'm this kind of person. What did you do to me?" And I think that's our first reaction, isn't it? If we were to lose even a fraction of what he lost, we would shake the fist at God, right? We would say, "God, how dare you?" And we would begin to list all the things we've done for him. "God, you know, I've tried to be faithful. I'm better than these other people. How dare you? I don't deserve this." You know, Job never does that. And you know, James, in a very specific way, he says, be like Job. Now, the part that you have to understand, and the reason why the book of Job is so interesting, is in the book of Job, you see behind the scenes. And the behind the scenes story is that Satan goes up to God and he says, "God, here is Job, the man who loves you, but I bet if I turn his life around, he will curse you. I bet if I take away the things that he loves in this life, he will stop loving you." And God says, "Go ahead." And so Satan goes down, he causes the whirlwind. He does, even the way that he takes away Job's wealth and his family, even the way he does that looks like God. But Satan goes down, he takes away all those things. And you know, Job doesn't know that that's going on. Only you and I do as readers. Only you and I know what's happening behind the scenes. And what you and I know that Job does not know is this. Job's friends don't understand this. What you and I know is that God is sovereign, but he's not specifically responsible. In other words, God oversees everything, but God didn't say, you know what? It's time for me to bring Job down. You know, it's not that God was saying, going, muhaha, here I go, pow, pow, pow. You know, we have this behind the scenes thing where we see that God is actually the opposite of what Job's friends think. Now, Job's friends think that it's God's hand, that God is doing this thing, and he's raining down a wrath and anger and judgment. But because you and I see behind the scenes, what we see is God is being compassionate and merciful. He's saying, you can do these things, but you can't kill him. You can do these things, but at the end of the story, what does God do? He returns everything back to him. Because you and I see behind the scenes, we see that God is actually being loving, as strange as that sounds. Right? Job loses everything, but God is being loving in that. He's not being wrathful. He's not being angry. He's not being just. On the outside, it looks like God is being incredibly vengeful. But behind the scenes, you see that God is actually being merciful. And you know, the reason why James brings this up is because for you and I, when suffering hits your life, you're like Job. You can't see behind the curtain. And because you can't see behind the curtain, it looks like God is angry and wrathful and vengeful. It looks like he is shaking his fist at you. And so you want to shake your fist at him. But the story of Job says, it may look as if God is causing a calamity, as if God is doing terrible things, but he's not. He's being compassionate and he's being merciful. And so that's one of the questions you have to ask. In the midst of terrible things happening in your life, you need to ask the question, what is God doing? And you know, the danger to asking that question is we do harbor secret beliefs. We do harbor a secret belief that God is selfish. And you know, I don't know if you understand, the reason why we think that God is selfish, the reason why we think God does everything for himself is because that's what we're like, right? So we attribute that to God too. Of course, I would do that. We attribute that to God. I think the other secret belief we have is that God is capricious, that he changes his mind, that he does what he wants, that he shoots lightning out when he feels like it, that he's angry when he wants to be, that he's kind when he wants to be. And those are I think those secret beliefs are the reasons why we shake our fist at God. But you see, when you ask the question biblically, when you ask, what is God doing in the midst of your troubles, in the midst of your problems, in the midst of your suffering and difficulty, when you ask, what is God doing, the answer that the Bible consistently gives is God is being patient, God is being kind, God is being compassionate, God is being merciful, God is being loving. And you see, the reason why Job is so important is because it's the message of this. It may not seem like that, but that's what's going on behind the curtain. And you see, you and I need that reminder. We need that reminder that on the surface, it might not look like that at all. It might look like wrath and anger and vengeance, but we can't see behind the curtain. Behind the curtain, if we were able to sneak behind the curtain of our lives, God would be there being merciful and gracious. And you know, that changes you. When you really do believe that that's what God is doing, then it changes your attitude. Now, we're going to end with this question. And we're going to kind of use it as, you know, as we move into communion. But the question is this. How can you really know that God is being compassionate and merciful? Because you can't, honestly, you can't see behind the scenes, right? In the midst of your problem, even if you say, God, show me what's going on behind the scenes, I know of very few people who've gotten a chance to look behind the curtain like that, right? You don't get a chance to do that. You know, things are happening in your workplace or in your personal life or in your spiritual life. God doesn't simply say, okay, let me show you. Whoop, you know, there it is. Oh, God, there you are. You're being so wonderful. You're being so kind. These other things are happening. Thank God. I'm going to move forward. I'm going to be patient. I'm going to deal with this. That doesn't happen. So the question is, how can you really know? If you can't look behind the scenes, how can you really know? Well, for Job, he really couldn't know. I mean, he could be told, but I mean, that only goes so far. For you and I, we actually do have something. And it's something that is absolutely convincing. You know, for you and I, how do we know that God is actually being compassionate and merciful? For us, all we have to do is we have to look to the cross. The cross is God's answer to that. You know, the reason why Jesus died on the cross was he died as a substitution, as an atonement. And in doing that, he showed us that God's plan from the beginning and God's plan to the end is not to smite and destroy. His plan from the very beginning that will culminate at the very end is that God has come to redeem, that God has come to save, that God has come to love you with a loving kindness, a compassion, a mercy that you do not deserve. And the only way you can know that, you can know it two ways. You can peel the curtain back and you can look behind, you can see. Or you can leave the curtain closed, but you can go to the cross. And on the cross, you see everything about what God is truly about. Now, that's one of the amazing things about being a Christian, is at the heart of our faith, we have suffering, and at the heart of our suffering, we have a God who also suffered. And he doesn't just suffer as an example. His suffering changes our suffering. And so when you go through suffering, and you say, why me? Why this? God, what are you doing? Boom, we go to the cross and we say, God is always doing good. How do I know? Because I see him who died for me. And you know, that's what communion is about. Communion is not just this thing that we do that reminds us of these tenets of our faith. The bread and the wine actually remind us that Jesus isn't wrathful. He isn't there to show us up in our sin. It's a reminder that God came, that Jesus came in compassion and mercy and love to rescue us. And that in his suffering, in his death, and in his resurrection, we can truly be transformed. We can be redeemed, we can be changed, and that we can become new people. I'm gonna ask if the elders and the deacons can make their way up to help hand out communion. And as they're making their way up, I'm gonna say a quick word of a prayer for us.